It's so great that you're back on campus. I am intrigued why an Oberlin alumnus would work at the Wall Street Journal.
Well, the Wall Street Journal does great journals. They do great journalism. We won a Pulitzer Prize for our coverage of Trump and our exposing of the payments around Stormy and Karen McDougal. We were the ones who broke the fact, and we did this before the 2016 election, just several days before, that Trump had an affair with Karen McDougal and that the National Enquirer had paid her basically a capture and kill fee, a fee to buy her story and prevent her from telling it, but that they had no intent of publishing it. So we do tough, rigorous journalism. The editorial page is separate. We don't interact much with them, and they certainly don't control our work. That said, you know, each publication has its audience and has its own appetites and complexion. The people who run the journal are trying to make it neutral in tone. In an environment where there's a lot of shouting, we are encouraged to limit our adjectives, limit our adverbs, and let the facts speak. You can find humor in the journal. It's applied carefully and specifically. But on any day that you pick up the journal, you will find a great story somewhere in that paper, and more than one. Working at the journal has also really made me appreciate coverage of business and the economy as a lens for looking at the world. I had been a business reporter for a stint before then, but I would encourage anyone who has any opportunity to cover any aspect of business or to cover the economy. You're an economics major, so you know this. Economics is a great lens for looking at the world. And if you're interested in inequality, if you're interested in the urban-rural divide, if you're interested in the urban-urban divide, if you're interested in why some cities are moving ahead and some are straggling, if you're interested in why we have Donald Trump, the opportunity to learn about economics and economic data and use that lens to explore the world is a great opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely, and I probably set you up badly there, but I appreciate certainly the sort of the importance of economics and journalism, and really rigorous reporting. And actually, I think one of the things that it's nice as an Oberlin student I've been privy to is access to the New York Times, and I've been disappointed that there's not sort of corresponding like student subscription to the Wall Street Journal, because the articles that I can access and can look at, I've really appreciated. And as a podcast fan, one of the top, I would say, daily podcasts that I really get the most out of is the Journal. And so that's opened my ears and my eyes to, I think, other reporting that I wouldn't necessarily find otherwise. So yeah, I totally get your point and appreciate you saying all that. One of the great things about having this Oberlin Journalism Symposium is having folks from all sorts of different journalistic capacities and backgrounds and things like that. So just as an introduction, unfortunately, I missed your talk, and I think probably other students weren't able to come just during the lunch hour and things like that. Would you mind telling a little bit about your background and what you just in brief went over at the talk?
Sure. So I have two main things that I would like people at Oberlin to know about journalism. The first is, it's hugely exciting. It is really wondrous. The tools we now have in journalism for storytelling, we finally have the muscle to tell stories visually, in interactive graphics, in static graphics, in video, in ways that are so compelling. We used to tell stories only through text. Now we can take you somewhere through storytelling formats that mix a bit of video, a bit of text, a bit of graphics, or that are all visual. And we can meet readers where they are, on their cell phones, on their desktops, on their smart speakers. And we need to do this because we're in a competitive situation. We're not just competing with the New York Times, the Washington Post. We're competing with everything on your cell phone. We're competing with your Headspace app. We're competing with your Reddit app. We're competing with Amazon. Anything that can take your attention, we're in competition with. And we want to do great, impactful journalism that's meaningful to people and that reveals things to people. And we want to keep up our watchdog function. We want to make sure that we are watching our government officials and the people who have power in the business sector and in the government sector. And we want people to read this journalism. And so now we have tools to tell stories in so many different ways and in so many different formats. And it's very exciting. It's especially exciting for those of us who came out of legacy print journalism, where we wrote words on, printed them on paper. So that's one message. The second message is that because of this, there's something that you would know intuitively because you listen to podcasts or you travel the internet, but it's important to know how much the newsroom has changed. And it's changed just in the last few weeks. It's changed so much. When I think back to the Washington Bureau of the last presidential election, here's one measure of change. 2016, when I was trying to push our journalism to interactive graphics, video, and new formats, which was something that I worked on in the 2016 election, we had one graphics person in the Washington Bureau and one video person, and that video person really wasn't working off the news. Today, the 2020 election, we have five graphics people in our bureau. We have three people who have job titles that didn't exist even 2 years ago. They're data reporters. One of them is a census expert and is just really great at finding stories in census data and helping us massage census data to tell stories. One works in political finance, political data, campaign finance, and the like. One is a general data reporter, but he wrote the professional book on SQL, the relational database. So many reporters now, even beyond those data reporters, use Python and use R and know how to scrape data off of websites and how to analyze that data. And it makes their reporting so much better and so impactful. And then we have people who think a lot about demographic and economic data, which is something that I'm charged with doing. Then beyond that, you know, beyond the people right around me who work in graphics, and we have two video people, data reporters, I think about who's up in New York at our main office who wasn't there before. We have people who work on tools and templates. When you see a website that has a lot of motion on it, you know, maybe it's showing you, maybe you're following a North Korean rocket from North Korea to its American target, or any other thing that moves on the screen, yeah. Someone is coding that. Someone had to take time and write the code for that to work. We want, and that takes time. We want to minimize that. We want me, as a layman, to be able at my desk to create cool interactive journalism. So people have to create the templates. We are watching, everyone watches page views, how many readers come to each story. We want to move beyond the page view and find ways to analyze audience data, to get stories to people when they're most likely to read them, so that we're very useful. We have new formats. We have an AI product that covers artificial intelligence. We have a bankruptcy product. We have a workplace product. What it means for people coming out of a place like Oberlin is there are more opportunities to be in journalism than before. The heart of it is still what it was. It's storytelling. It's reporting. It's editing. It's building sources. It's finding things, whether it's breaking news or features that they didn't know. But there are just so many more skills and so many more job functions and so many more opportunities in the newsroom than before.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, you sort of came out of more a legacy of print journalism and have seen all of this change and things like that. I'd be interested to know what your trajectory has been from Oberlin to the Wall Street Journal and sort of everything in between, what the story is there.
Well, I worked at the Review, you know, that was a great start. I remember applying for an internship at the Cleveland Plain Dealer while I was a student, and I must have borrowed a car from someone, and I went up there, and the guy looked at my clips and said, well, clearly you can't write very well. So I came back to Oberlin and tried to do some more writing. And when I came out, journalism to me, I had this image in my head of this sheer black glass wall. That was journalism. And there was no door. There were no handholds. It was just this obsidian object that I somehow wanted to climb, and I had no ladder to get up it. And I volunteered at a small community paper in Boston, the South End News, and got a few clips. And then I got a full-time job at a small weekly paper, the Burlington, Massachusetts Advertiser, and got on a third weekly after that. And finally, I think about 3 years out of Oberlin, got to a good daily, the Concord Monitor in New Hampshire, where I could really learn how to be a reporter in a community. And it was a writer's paper, and you could be creative and explore. And that was my start in print journalism. And my job for many years was to try to come up with stuff that was cool enough and interesting enough to get on the front page and be above the fold on the front page. I covered business. I had a great run as a science reporter covering the emerging science of the genome, the race to sequence the genome, the start of biotech crops. It was religion and business and commerce and government regulation all mixed in. It was great. But in 2015, heading into the 2016 election, I was asked to move out of writing print stories and to help push our journalism to new formats, video, interactive graphics, static graphics for the 2016 election. And that's where I moved into somewhat different storytelling.
That's great. And
these answers are very long, by the way.
Oh, no, please. We have plenty of time. So say whatever you like. That's great.
Well, I hope it's a conversation as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting to hear you describe the sleek obsidian surface because, I think there's certainly sort of hope for the future, at least for myself and other seniors on the show as well. But sometimes it does sort of feel that way, and it's good to know that despite the lack of appearances of footholds, you made your way, like so many other Oberlin journalists.
I'd like to say I remember that period of leaving college, that first year or two after college. And honestly, it was challenging. It's really wonderful to be here at Oberlin, where so many people around you are about your age, and you have so many good friends. And then you go into the world, and it's like on a pool table where the cue ball breaks, and the balls scatter around, and you're left to try to find your way into a career. And I was lucky to be able to move to Boston with a bunch of friends and at least have about a year where we lived together. And one at a time, people found what was coming next. Law school for some, other graduate schools, or me finding at least a start in journalism. But that period, it was a lot of fun, but it definitely was challenging.
Yeah. And what was your time at Oberlin like? You said you were with the Review and presumably spent some time in Burton Basement or thereabouts.
The Review was off campus at that point.
Oh, really?
It was in a building off of Main Street somewhere.
Oh, cool.
Oberlin was just wonderful. What a great place. I had a mix of friends who traveled more conventional paths and some who traveled less conventional paths. I had friends who decided that they were going to camp out every night instead of paying for a dorm room. And every night they would go out into the Arb and set up a tent. You know, I had friends who, if they decided to have a beach party, would go steal a bunch of sand from the golf course, bring it into their dorm, and set up a beach party. We hitchhiked around the country. We took full advantage of the opportunities of being a young person, surrounded by other fun young people. And when each of us got married, there always was skinny dipping involved. That's the main It's funny, you know, I'm old enough now that my kids are going to college, and so we've looked at a lot of colleges. And as I think about what is important after so many years being out, yeah, I got a great education. Yeah, I like the values of Oberlin. My Oberlin identity has been really part of me. I married an Oberlin graduate. But it's really the fact that 30 years out, I have these friends over all this time that I've traveled all these years with, who I've seen move through their lives, and we still get together. One group of us every other year goes hiking. Another group of us will have a reunion on someone's farm in Wisconsin this year. That's a great thing to have taken away from college.
Yeah, that sounds great. And certainly it's the community. And when I was thinking about coming to Oberlin versus like other schools, and didn't exactly know what way, I knew a couple of former OBs and current OBs, and what stood out to me was like the people and the fact that I would, you know, have fun and enjoy their company and you know, be inspired by other folks. So.
I have a friend who's made his way in puppet theater, and now he's one of the world's foremost entrepreneurs and experts in puppet theater, and created a biennial international puppet festival in Chicago. That's just amazing. It'll knock your socks off. He brings in artists from around the world. I have a friend who had physical problems as a pianist and learned relaxation techniques, and many years later turned that into a business. And now she goes into businesses as the head of a company that she created with a big staff, and teaches proper motion and relaxation to people who do repetitive stress, bench scientists, people who sit at keyboards. People really invented interesting careers for themselves out of Oberlin.
In particular, do you think there's a connection between OBs and journalism or storytelling and things like that? Why there are so many, I guess what you're saying too is there's so many OBs doing all sorts of stuff, and it doesn't even really have to fit in one journalism box. But the nice thing to reflect on right now is, you know, the new concentration in journalism and having all these great alumni come back to campus. Do you think there's something indicative about the Oberlin as a place or the education style
Just has to be. As we were saying earlier, at one point in my career, I was a flat-out business reporter reporting on high-tech businesses in Boston, and that's when it struck me that I did not know any Oberlin graduates who would have been the people I talked to in that meet. I didn't know anyone who was a financial analyst or a stock analyst or a CFO or a corporate lawyer even. I guess I do know some who are corporate lawyers, but not who are working directly at big companies. Oberlin graduates cluster elsewhere, and I think they take their curiosity. We take our curiosity, and we use it to explore the world, whether it's through the arts or the lens of economics or journalism. And it is remarkable. I can think of Michael Duffy, Time Magazine, Tom Hamburger at the Washington Post, Paul Schwartzman at the Washington Post, Bob Drogan at the LA Times, and then all the younger people who are at different podcasts and documentary production companies. We are a curious bunch, and we want to learn about the world around us. And I think that's why we cluster in journalism.
And even the ability to sort of care about those stories that, you know, we hear about and then we see happening in the world, and then telling them and sharing them, I think
wake up and we want to, as you say, tell about the world, learn about the world, and share it. And relatively few of us wake up and say, how do I meet my sales goal? How am I going to make a dollar? Fewer of us that I know, at least in my experience, organize our lives around money and hitting financial goals, and more organize our lives around exploring the world.
Yeah. What's it like then to sort of cover that as a business reporter, cover that sector? And what have you learned about the ways that either OBs could learn from that, or that, you know, the business sector, I guess I looking at what you do, it's really interesting in that you sort of combine both of those, both sort of storytelling and also graphics and data and things that, you know, some people would say is more align with, you know, business interests or things like that. But you do a great job of really mixing the two. Is that difficult?
Well, a couple thoughts are coming up at once. Let's talk about business reporting and then let's talk about the economy. This journalism concentration really should think about how to get business and economy in the mix. And I guess there's a stat component. And I don't know the full, I've met with some of the professors and I've read the lineup, but forgive me for not having full mastery of everything that's going to be in the concentration.
Yeah.
Anyone who has the opportunity to cover business in any facet, I would encourage you to take it. First of all, they're just great stories. Look at what the journal has written in the last few years. The WeWork story is a great story about a guy in a traditional real estate business marketing himself as a high-tech company and convincing people to put tons of money into this, and how he, you know, we had this great story about him flying internationally on rented planes with marijuana, you know, highly illegal and unconventional leadership. We had this great story about Theranos, the company that was going to diagnose all kinds of diseases from a single drop of blood, and it turned out to be not true. These are very human, interesting stories. People acting in the work world are as interesting as people anywhere else. People making money is interesting. People losing money is interesting. And now our watchdog function extends to the high-tech sector. We need people who are sophisticated in understanding algorithms and AI. And we need someone on. If you're going to cover Facebook, and we need to cover Facebook and Google, we need to have people who understand if you download an app and plug in your data, where is that data going? You know how to track it. So one, business reporting is very interesting. Second, the economy is just a great lens for understanding this world, especially in an era of political polarization and Donald Trump. Some of the work I've enjoyed most is looking at things like education levels in different congressional districts as a prism for understanding why they're trending Republican or trending Democratic. Education was not always a divider in this country. It did not predict people's vote until really about 2010. This is pretty recent, that education levels, the higher your level of educational attainment, and this is mostly true among white voters, black and Hispanic, it's a different story, but among white voters, the higher your educational attainment, the more likely you are to be Democratic and liberal, and the lower educational attainment, the more likely to be Republican. And this is new, it's big, and it's important. And we've done a lot of work looking at education and matching it against geography. So what do I mean by that? One of the mind-blowing factoids out of the last midterm election is that the Republican Party went into the midterms representing 10 of the 30 districts with the highest educational attainment, with the highest numbers, shares of people with a BA or more. They had 10 of the top 30. They came out of the midterms with 2 of the top 30. Now that is just a mind-blowing statistic. One of this nation's two political parties represents only 2 high education districts. Well, once we established that and wrote about that, we used other economic data to expand on it. Why do we care about education? Because it's a proxy for economic opportunity. So then we started looking at median income. We started looking at GDP. We started looking at where are professional jobs, where are agriculture jobs. And we broke this out by congressional district to kind of develop a Republican footprint and a Democratic footprint, and to have a sense of how income and job mix is changing. And these are facets of our lives that correspond to education. And what we can show through data is that compared with 10 years ago, the Democratic footprint is becoming much more wealthy, professional, diverse, and highly educated. In other words, we rounded out this picture of education as one facet of your life. And the Republican footprint compared to 10 years ago is becoming, in a growing country, Republican footprint in the U.S. House of Representatives is contributing less to GDP than 10 years ago. In a country that's getting more educated, the Republican footprint in the House is kind of stagnant or growing slightly in education. These, if you want to understand what's going on with Donald Trump and in politics and our political polarization, coming at it through a lens of economic data and demographic data and marrying that to kind of a political outlook is a really great prism. And I, in my mind, I see the country as kind of a Rubik's Cube where we used to have some white on the blue face and red on the orange face, and people were mixed up more geographically. But now all the facets of this Rubik's Cube are uniform. We are now segregated by geography. One party is rural and working class communities. The other party is metropolitan and inner suburbs. And this Rubik's Cube, where one side is education, one side is occupation, one side is diversity, one side is density, population density, and they all line up to create a picture of a polarized America, polarized economically and politically. And I find that mixing a lens of how do you view the economy of this country with a political lens is very illuminating.
When you have such fascinating and key sort of integral stories to tell about, you know, where America's at, what the political framework is, and you have all this data sort of showing that, how can you narrow in on things that you think your readers will really understand or that are sort of the most important points to pick up, and how can you show that with graphics and you know, graphs and data and things like that? Is it a difficult job to sort of separate all the signal from the noise?
Well, that's a great question, because people can't absorb the big sweep of things very easily. You need to find the example that proves your case. And that's another place where we use economic and political data. We work with people who have done what they call a cluster analysis. They've taken all 3,100 counties in this country and segregated them into a number of buckets based on their economic profile. Sometimes we use religion. But it's not enough to see this country as urban, suburban, and rural. That's too blunt an instrument. So we look at the country as we know the set of counties that we would call big city counties. We know the set of counties that we would call inner suburbs, the suburbs right outside. We know the set of counties that we would call exurbs. We have a set of counties that are kind of working class America. And these are kind of, these working class counties are important. It can be pretty urban. They can be, you know, like a Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, or a Scranton, or a community outside Detroit. They have higher than the national average for manufacturing. They are just below the median of national average for income. And they voted for Obama in 2008. They voted barely Republican in 2012, maybe 2 points. And then they swung very heavily to Donald Trump. This is a set of counties that run through Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, up into Wisconsin. When you can take the country and put geography into baskets like that, it's very helpful, because then you can pick a place and you can go to do what you do as a journalist, go to talk to people, but your story doesn't just have their voices. The place you're going to tells a story, and the data tells a story. So when I go to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, I can say, here's a place, it's deindustrializing, but still higher than average manufacturing, median income is kind of right below the average, and I can tell you that this place is growing more slowly than the nation as a whole, and I can tell you that this place swung very heavily for Donald Trump. And furthermore, I can tell you that this place is representative of these 20 other places or 80 other places that are in politically important parts of the country. This place, Wilkes-Barre, is similar to Westmoreland County outside Pittsburgh, another red county. It's similar to Macomb County outside Detroit. These are places where Trump ran up the score and got huge margins. And we can go there and we can talk to people. Hey, the economy is barely growing. And yet, what do you think about the president now? How enthusiastic are you? And so when we go to tell a story, we're localizing it in a place. That place represents other places that are meaningful. And we're using the data about the place to help build our narrative, as well as using the voices of the people we find there.
And I read a lot of news as a news-obsessed junkie, so I love digging in on all the background. That's great. One thing that I've heard a lot of discussion about, especially with the presidential race in full swing, is sort of gauging polls and looking back to 2016 and how people sort of had faith in what the polls were telling them, and then not necessarily perhaps understanding what, you know, a 66% for Trump or for Hillary necessarily means, and then sort of being frustrated with the outcomes not always skewing in that direction. Do you have sort of, did that change sort of your framework or the framework of other journalists that you work with? And then do you have faith for sort of both, I guess, like journalism's reliance on polls and then sort of readership's understanding of what those polls are telling them?
So you are asking a polite version of a question that is totally legitimate and that we get a lot, which is, how did you guys get it so wrong? Mm-hmm. What happened? I have been lucky in my job for the last 10 years to work very intimately with the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. It's one of the nation's longest running political surveys. We just hit our 30th year of polling. And I'm a big believer in polling still. But it's gotten more complicated, which we can talk about. But just coming to 2016, I have two answers for how we performed in 2016. There's the defensive answer. The defensive answer is, we got it right. We didn't get it wrong. We're a national poll. We, and by the way, the Washington Post and I think Fox had the same number, had Hillary up by 4 at the end. She won by a little more than 2. It's well within the margin of error. The guys who got it wrong weren't us. They were the state polls. And the state polls didn't weight properly. They didn't properly sample for basically Trump voters, for people without college degrees. They undersampled people with lower educational attainment and therefore undersampled people who were open to the Trump message. And also the state polls weren't in the field at the very end. And there were a lot of people who were sour on both Trump and Clinton. They decided late and they swung toward Trump. And if you weren't in the field at the end, you wouldn't have captured that. So that's our defensive answer. We were just fine. A more honest answer is, yeah, we had the numbers. We have faith in our numbers, but too often we told the wrong story. We had Hillary up by a lot in some of our polls, and those were probably fair snapshots at the time. We had her leading by as much as 10, I think. But if we had the numbers, we didn't have the imagination to write a better story out of it. We were very focused on the fact that for every voter Trump was bringing in through his unconventional style, he was alienating another voter somewhere else. And we did not pay enough attention to the fact that Hillary Clinton had a lot of flaws as a candidate and also wasn't well-liked. We think a lot now about, when we look at the numbers, what is the best case that we can make for both parties and for all the candidates. We've also changed our sampling methods. We've gone from throwing out a net to everyone in the general public to working off of voter lists, which I think gives us a better sample. We do draw a larger share of voters with lower educational attainment, and we've made our polls shorter to minimize the number of people that hang up. By the way, like all good pollsters, we monitor for non-response bias. We monitor for who declines to take our poll or who hangs up in the middle of the poll in order to make sure that disproportionately some groups are opting out. We use live interviewers on telephone with a very large cell phone component. So we've made some adjustments. The biggest one being, are we reading the numbers in the best light for both parties. There's one other thing I'll say about polling, which is a lot of attention goes to the horse race. And we publish horse race numbers all the time. Every 5 weeks or 6 weeks, we have a poll. And we will say Bernie's in the lead, or Biden's in the lead, or here's what Trump is versus Warren, or Trump is versus Buttigieg. The greater value of the poll, and what we've been doing much more with, and including in our visual journalism, is learning, using the poll to learn about America, to learn about changing family structure, women in the workplace, comfort with diversity, or lack of comfort with diversity, things that are the drivers of our daily lives and are the drivers of political polarization. We have a longitudinal, we have a lot of data just about this country and attitudes over time. And that's where I think the higher value of the poll is. And that's what I try to use in my reporting most of all.
Yeah, well, that's great. And certainly, I mean, I think as someone who is engaged with the news and likes to track the horse race, because it's hard not to. I really appreciate all the polling, and I'm always sort of looking for coverage that has, you know, a more nuanced evaluation of what's being said and what's in the granular data there. But it certainly, even as a reader, it's hard not to get like wrapped up in the, you know, who's ahead today and what does this poll say?
Yeah,
and
people
not
get
really,
addicted, don't they? And they click.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, you can track how many times I upload or you know, reload 538 every day on the day of whatever primary. So
yeah, people are like, is my team gonna win or lose? Is my guy gonna win? Is my
exactly.
guy gonna lose?
Yep. Yeah, hard not to do, but very, very important too to have a sort of the other element of you know, what's really going on and getting into the specifics of the data and, you know, what the underlying stories are and how those affect other things as well. Well, we don't have a ton more time, but this has been lovely. I guess one more question maybe, if that's all right. Do you have a favorite journalism story that you've worked on over the years, or a preferred way of sort of demonstrating, you know, the data to your readers?
Well, I do think that this prism of looking at education and income and GDP and how that's changed in Republican-heavy places and Democratic-heavy places is pretty illuminating, and I'm looking for places to bring that to ground. I'm looking for places I can go to bring that story alive and show how the economy is driving political attitudes. And it's complicated because, I think it's true that identity and cultural issues are driving politics, but these things are all facets of the same lives that we live. I don't know. We did a story recently that I thought was kind of fun, which is a good example of the kind of thing you can do with data. We got a database from a market research company of 2,500 brands, Kleenex tissues, Krispy Kreme donuts, different TV shows, Fox News, MSNBC, different brands of beer, different brands of cars. And these market research companies, they ask a lot of questions about who's taking their surveys. We just asked them for data on who identifies as a Republican and who identifies as a Democrat in their customer base. And so we got this big data set that covered 15 years, so we could look at which products had changed their political profile over time. And we saw that a meaningful number of products had shifted from either a more Republican customer base to more Democratic, or more Democrat to more Republican. Now, what we wanted was a story about how now everything is partisan, even our consumer choices. But we had to be careful, because if you're selling a product in malls outside of Boston, but you're not selling it in Oklahoma, you're going to get a more Democratic customer base. And it has nothing to do immediately with the fact that people might be making consumer choices based on their politics. That's the story that we thought was there, people making consumer choices based on their politics. If you're Courvoisier, or Chivas Regal, and you're, you know, a liquor, and you used to have a customer base that was conservative, older people, and now you're going after kids and cocktail culture, and you're placing your product in hip-hop videos or being mentioned on Saturday Night Live, you're gonna get a much more democratic consumer base. Are we really saying something about politics there, or are we just saying that that brand is chasing younger consumers? So we had to kind of report out and disentangle these things. In the end, we did identify a set of brands that we think had been signaling to customers, sometimes overtly and sometimes less so, about their politics, and as a result had seen a changing customer base. And the example we used at the top of the story was blue jeans. Fashion is good because it's a style, it's a lifestyle choice. And Levi's, which has been adopting a lot of liberal causes like gun safety, has skewed Democratic, and Wrangler, which sponsors rodeos, it's less overtly political, but they're doing the country Western thing, is skewed more Republican. And we found a set of brands like that. And I thought it was a nifty way of showing that partisanship is inhabiting all parts of our lives.
Yeah, what a striking story. Certainly. And you can see it everywhere. I mean, you can see it in Oberlin, what brands people, you know, use and what they make memes about and things like that. So certainly.
Yeah, are you Nikes or Allbirds or
what? Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. Anything else you want to add or any last thoughts?
No, it's hard to not sound cheesy or sappy or nostalgic, but my Oberlin identity has really been part of me. It stays with me. And I'm very proud of this school and to be here and to see such intelligence and optimism and just it's very uplifting, bright place to be. And thank you for inviting me back.
Yeah. Thank you for coming. It's been a pleasure.